From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, how the Christian right consolidated so much power. We talk with Michelle Goldberg about her new book, Kingdom Coming, The Rise of Christian Nationalism. Christian nationalism is her term for a totalistic political ideology linked to a literal reading of the Bible that she describes as driving a great many of the fights over religion, science, sex, and pluralism. Goldberg covers the culture wars for the online magazine Salon. Also, music critic Milo Miles reviews the new album Saint Elsewhere by Gnarls Barkley, the fictional combined persona of producer and DJ Danger Mouse and rapper and songwriter CeeLo. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Michelle Goldberg, is the author of a new book about the rise of Christian nationalism. Christian nationalism is her term for the movement that has tied together a fundamentalist Christian point of view with a right-wing political ideology, conflating scripture and politics. Her book, Kingdom Coming, examines how this movement has consolidated so much power. Goldberg is a senior writer at the online magazine Salon, where she reports on the culture wars. Michelle Goldberg, welcome to Fresh Air. In your new book, you've described the religious right as a parallel culture. What do you mean?
I mean that it's not just a religious movement anymore. It has not only its own kind of political institutions, also its own law firms, its own revisionist history of America, its own scientific quasi-scientific research organs, its own journals. And what we're seeing, especially in the Bush administration, is the slow replacement of what we think of as reality with this parallel version, so that you have basically, you know, scientists or doctors or lawyers who adhere to an entirely different worldview with an entirely different set of facts slowly being infiltrated, I guess, into the workings of our government.
Give me an example of what you mean by an expert who has a different set of facts who's now being infiltrated into the government.
Well, one of the best examples, I think, is what's going on right now with the CDC. As you probably know,
the Center for Disease Control.
The Center for Disease Control, right. As you probably know, there was recently supposed to be a panel about the failure of abstinence education, which is something that almost all mainstream scientists who've studied abstinence education have been able to document. Now, a congressman from Indiana found out about this panel and decided it wasn't balanced because he said that the fact that all of the scientists had come to a specific conclusion means that they are by definition biased, and that this conclusion needs to be balanced with a pro-abstinence conclusion. And so he was able to go to a woman named Patricia Sulak, who is the author of an abstinence curriculum called Worth the Wait. She's affiliated with a group called the Medical Institute for Sexual Health, which sounds scientific, but it is essentially a kind of parallel institution that exists to buttress abstinence education and that exists to attack the use of condoms and to attack the teaching of safe sex and comprehensive sex education. And so every mainstream scientist and mainstream researcher has discredited most of their claims. But in that parallel reality, those claims are as valid, if not more valid, than what scientists are coming up with.
The subtitle of your book, Kingdom Coming, is The Rise of Christian Nationalism. What do you mean by Christian nationalism?
There's the ideology of the movement that I'm describing believes that America was founded as a Christian nation, that the founders never intended a separation of church and state, and that America must be restored to its Christian origins. What that means is not that they want Christianity to be forced on all of Americans, as much as they want Christianity to be kind of honored as the inspiration for the Republic, and also the kind of overriding ideology of the country. You know, Jews and other religious minorities would be able to practice their religion, but it would be within the context of a Christian country where Christianity is dominant and privileged.
What leads you to that conclusion, that's the type of country that Christian nationalists want?
A few years ago, Congress invited a Hindu priest to give the invocation, and it was the first time that a Hindu priest had been invited. And the Family Research Council, which is a very powerful Christian right lobbying group in Washington, D.C., issued this furious statement that said, "While it is true that the United States of America was founded on the sacred principle of religious freedom for all, that liberty was never intended to exalt other religions to the level that Christianity holds in our country's heritage. Our founders expected that Christianity and no other religion would receive support from the government as long as that support did not violate people's consciences and their right to worship. they would have found utterly incredible the idea that all religions, including paganism, be treated with equal deference. And so you hear this rhetoric a lot, that this is a Christian nation. And one of the chief purveyors of this kind of revisionist history is a man named David Barton, who is the vice chairman of the Texas Republican Party and who, you know, travels the country incessantly giving lectures about how America was founded as a Christian nation and needs to be restored, and that this kind of true heritage of America has been perverted and corrupted by leftists and secularists.
You devote a chapter in your book to homeschooling. What's the connection between homeschooling and the religious right?
Well, we're seeing an increasing attack and rejection of the public schools by the Christian right. The idea is that the public schools are basically incubators of secularism, that they are, you know, teaching kids this doctrine that rejects Jesus. I mean, which is true. The public schools don't, unlike the Christian right, don't see the Bible as the fount of all knowledge and understanding of the world. So increasingly, you see Christian conservatives taking their kids out of the public schools and teaching them at home. I think the numbers are somewhere between 1.1 and 2.1 million students who are now being homeschooled. And when I spoke before about a parallel reality, in homeschooling curricula, that reality is the only reality presented. So that what they're learning is essentially an entirely different set of facts. You know, they're learning, in many cases, the revisionist history of David Barton about America's Christian founding. They're learning creationism, in many cases quite advanced forms of creationism. You know, you can buy college textbooks about creationist astronomy or creationist chemistry or physics. And increasingly, through the efforts of a man named Michael Ferris, as well as others, Michael Ferris is the founder of the Homeschool Legal Defense Fund. Increasingly, you're seeing these homeschooled kids being organized into political cadres and dispatched for weeks out of the year to work on various right-wing campaigns with their expenses paid by Ferris's organization.
Well, Ferris founded something called Generation Joshua. What is the goal of this group?
Generation Joshua, I mean, it takes its name from the Joshua of the Bible, who Moses led the Israelites out of their exile, but he never got to the promised land. It was Joshua who finally, you know, made war on the Canaanites and reconquered Israel. And the goal of Generation Joshua is to train homeschooled kids who've been let out of the godless public schools by their parents to reconquer American culture and exercise dominion over not only all aspects of politics, but all aspects of American life.
How politically connected is Michael Ferris?
Although I haven't seen George W. Bush publicly embrace Michael Ferris, he is clearly deeply intertwined with the modern Republican Party. The head of Generation Joshua is a guy named Ned Ryan, who was a former speechwriter for George W. Bush and is the son of Congressman Jim Ryan. And Michael Ferris runs a college called Patrick Henry College, which is devoted to basically turning homeschooled students into leaders in the government. And it's a very small school, and given its size, you know, something less than 200 students total, he's been incredibly effective in placing these kids in really coveted internships. In 2004, 7% of the White House interns came from Patrick Henry College. I mean, the only other school that had numbers even close to that, I believe, was Georgetown.
Are there particular campaigns you can point to that you think students from Generation Joshua have been particularly influential in? And this is a pretty new project. It was only founded in 2004.
Right. It was founded in 2004. And in 2004, Generation Joshua paid all the travel and all the living expenses for hundreds of kids to work both on Bush's campaign in swing states and also on the senatorial campaign of very far-right senators like Tom Coburn in Oklahoma, who's a man who has called for the death penalty for abortionists, and Jim DeMint in South Carolina, who's a man who said that unmarried mothers shouldn't be teaching in public schools. Both Coburn and DeMint were victorious. And while you can't attribute that solely to Generation Joshua, obviously, the fact that you have these kind of subsidized groups of very zealous volunteers who are basically working on these campaigns full time is obviously very valuable.
You describe Michael Farris as a protege of Tim LaHaye. Tim LaHaye co-authored the Left Behind series, the apocalyptic series about what happens just before the second coming of Christ. Do you know if Farris believes, as LaHaye does, that the second coming and the end of days is imminent?
I can't speak to what Farris believes. I would say that the belief that you're talking about is called premillennial dispensationalism. You know, the belief that there's shortly going to be a rapture where all the believers are gathered up to heaven, followed by a third world war in the Middle East, an Armageddon, and a final battle between Jesus and the Antichrist, and after which there'll be 1,000 years of peace on earth. That is the dominant belief among American evangelicals.
Do you think that has an influence on the political movement of the Christian right, that belief that the Second Coming is imminent?
Well, it's actually interesting because if it has an influence, it's actually been in the past a negative influence. Because if you believe that the Second Coming is imminent, that inspires a certain kind of passivity. I mean, there's no reason to try to save a world that's on its last legs. And so something that Tim LaHaye was able to do that was very, very important was to kind of politicize premillennial dispensationalism and to kind of create a theological justification for this very intense political involvement, despite the fact that the world is, kind of lurching towards Armageddon.
My guest is Michelle Goldberg. Her new book is called Kingdom Coming, The Rise of Christian Nationalism. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Michelle Goldberg, and her new book is called Kingdom Coming, The Rise of Christian Nationalism. And she reports on the religious right and other issues for the online magazine Salon. You write about a Christian movement called Reconstructionism. What is this movement about, and how big is it?
Christian Reconstructionism is tiny but very influential. It was founded by a guy named R.J. Rushdoony. And essentially, while most American evangelicals are premillennial dispensationalists. So while most American evangelicals believe that the second coming is imminent and that after this kind of final battle, there will be 1,000-year reign of peace on earth, Christian Reconstructionists are postmillennialists. That means that they believe that they first have to establish the 1,000-year reign of Christianity before Jesus will return. So that makes them much more proactive because there's just much more of a role for kind of human agency in bringing about the second coming. And Christian Reconstructionism is probably the most extreme form of Christian fundamentalism. It prescribes something very much like a Christian Taliban. It calls for the imposition of Leviticus, the execution of homosexuals, the execution of adulterers, the execution of women who are unchaste before marriage. This is not a vision that is very attractive, even among most fundamentalists. But Christian Reconstructionism, because it has a vision of the necessity of people transforming society and taking over society, has developed a political philosophy called dominionism, which holds that Christians have both the right and the duty to kind of take over all aspects of society, that there's a Christian right to rule. And this philosophy has kind of filtered down. It's become very influential, partly through Tim LaHaye. There's been a number of organizations, notably the Coalition on Revival, where Reconstructionists and premillennialists like Tim LaHaye have joined forces to, you know, have kind of put aside their eschatological disputes to try to combine forces to basically Christianize American society.
Through what movements or efforts or legislation? Through what?
Gary North, who is the son-in-law of Rush Juni and one of the most important Reconstructionist thinkers, has talked about the importance of infiltrating the existing political order to smooth the transition to Christian political leadership, as he put it. And this idea of this kind of stealth strategy to organize within current politics is something that was really popularized by the Christian Coalition, by Pat Robertson's Christian Coalition. So the idea is essentially that you take over first the party apparatus at the local level, the precinct level, the school board level. You know, once you've done that, you can kind of replace slowly what I would call, reality with this parallel version in all kinds of ways. Everything from trying to put creationism into the public schools to efforts to replace the teaching of American history with this kind of revisionist history about America's Christian roots. There's a big movement now to have Bible classes reintroduced to public schools. You're seeing it all over the country, especially in Georgia. And usually, I mean, the argument, and it's a legitimate argument, is that Christians have the same right to participate in politics as anyone else. And of course they do. But if you look at some of the writings of leaders of this movement, they're pretty clear that the goal is not participation in a pluralistic society, but that it's dominion. And so if I could just read George Grant, who used to be the executive director of D. James Kennedy's Coral Ridge Ministries, which is, you know, a huge televangelist empire based in Fort Lauderdale, one less well-known than people like James Dobson or Falwell or Robertson, but very, very big. And he wrote, "Christians have an obligation, a mandate, a commission, a holy responsibility to reclaim the land for Jesus Christ, to have dominion in civil structures, just as in every other aspect of life and godliness. But it is dominion we are after, not just a voice. It is dominion we are after, not just influence. It is dominion we are after, not just equal time. It is dominion we are after. World conquest. That's what Christ has commissioned us to accomplish." And so the goal is not necessarily a violent overthrow, although, I mean, there have been people who've advocated that. But it's essentially a kind of fundamental transformation of the country using the institutions of democracy, but in a way that is fundamentally opposed not just to the founders' vision of America, but also to the kind of pluralism that most of us have grown up taking for granted.
Is there any legislation proposed or passed that you think reflects the Reconstructionist point of view, a point of view that you described as very small in its number of followers, but very influential in the larger movement of the Christian right?
There haven't been laws passed that have been specifically derived from Christian Reconstructionism, although there have been Reconstructionist ideas kind of migrating increasingly into the public debate. I mean, it was really Christian Reconstructionists, along with members of the John Birch Society, you know, many decades ago, who first floated and developed the idea of impeaching judges whose rule contradicts the Bible, which is seen as the supreme source of law. And so if you see the Bible as the inspiration for the Constitution, any law that contradicts the Bible is kind of de facto unconstitutional. And so you've seen these legal arguments picked up increasingly by Republicans who are denouncing activist judges and things like that. There have been laws that have been proposed and that have found significant sponsorship in Congress that come from Christian Reconstructionism. And one of the most important is the Constitution Restoration Act. The Constitution Restoration Act would essentially strip courts of the ability to hear most Establishment Clause issues. So it would strip courts of the ability to rule on prayer in public schools, to rule on creationism in public schools, to rule on Ten Commandments monuments. because the federal courts would, you know, kind of lose so much of their jurisdiction, it would actually be possible for, say, a state to declare itself a Christian state. The understanding behind it is that the First Amendment applies to Congress. Congress shall make no law. And so they kind of reject the idea that this is binding at the local level.
Now, this Constitution Restoration Act was introduced in both houses of Congress. I don't think it got very far, but who were the legislators behind it?
Okay, the Constitution Restoration Act, you know, you're right. It's not going to pass anytime soon, although it did pass the House, and it found significant support among many of the leaders in the Senate, including Sam Brownback, Lindsey Graham from South Carolina, Trent Lott, who used to be the majority leader. It was, you know, it failed. It was reintroduced in 2005. And the GOP platform explicitly endorses the idea behind it. So although it's not going to become law anytime soon, it's also not a kind of marginal idea. It's something, the ideas behind it are really embraced by the people running the country. And it's the kind of thing that if they're able to solidify their control, or if there's another conservative president in 2008, it's certainly not beyond the realm of possibility.
Michelle Goldberg is the author of the new book, Kingdom Coming, The Rise of Christian Nationalism. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Bantam Books, publisher of Growing Girls, The Mother of All Adventures, a memoir by Jean Marie Laskus, author of The Exact Same Moon. From Warner Home Video, presenting the drama series The West Wing, the complete sixth season on DVD, including special features. And from Audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. Audible.com/fresh air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, how homosexuality became a target of the religious right. We continue our conversation with Michelle Goldberg, and music critic Milo Miles reviews the new album Saint Elsewhere by Gnarls Barkley, the combined fictional persona of a DJ and a rapper. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Michelle Goldberg, author of the new book Kingdom Coming, The Rise of Christian Nationalism. She describes Christian nationalism as a movement that claims the Bible is literally true and has extrapolated a total political program from that truth, yoking that program to a political party. How did gay rights get to be such a big issue within the Republican Party? And it was a very big issue for the Bush-Cheney platform when they ran the reelection campaign.
Well, I think there's a couple of different reasons. First of all, is that the Christian right has made alliances with so many of its former enemies. I mean, a lot of, you know, the Protestant right used to spend a lot of its time fighting Catholics. And nativists would write these tracts about all the kind of perversities and decadence of the convents. You know, now there's been, especially over abortion, there's increasingly a very close alliance between the Protestant right and the Catholic right. Anti-Semitism is taboo. I mean, it exists, but it is taboo mostly among the Protestant right. There tend to be very pro-Israel and to see Jews as the kind of agent of that, you know, the agent of the Second Coming. Racism has become very taboo among the Christian right. There's been a lot of efforts to reach out to Black evangelicals. But a movement needs an enemy. And the so-called homosexual agenda has become this kind of all-encompassing evil that is very a very potent force to mobilize against. And so there's all of these books about how they ascribe a power to a homosexual lobby that really recalls books like The Protocols of the Elders of Zion in their all-encompassing conspiracy theorizing. You know, there's books called The Pink Swastika and, you know, The Homosexual Agenda, and they usually talk about how the homosexual agenda doesn't want just rights for homosexuals. It wants to destroy the institution of marriage, recruit children into the cause, and ban Christianity. And so this has been a very, very powerful force in uniting all of these formerly disparate groups. And it was incredibly important to George Bush's election in 2004, because IRS rules prohibit churches from campaigning on behalf of specific candidates, but they are allowed to campaign on behalf of ostensibly nonpartisan issues like anti-gay ballot initiatives to ban gay marriage or to strip gay couples of, you know, partnership benefits, joint health insurance, things like that. And so, especially in Ohio, which is where I was in the months before the 2004 election, the churches were able to use the Issue One campaign, which was the campaign for an anti-gay marriage state constitutional amendment, to move a lot of the electoral apparatus into the churches so that the churches became, you know, centers for phone banking and voter registration. And when I went to the churches, you know, when I went to services before the 2004 election, I consistently heard entire sermons about the homosexuals and the and what they're trying to do to our state, and you need to form a mighty army and march on the voting booth to save the family and save Christianity and fight for the pulpit. And I think there's no doubt that not only was this incredibly potent, but it was very, very important in swaying Black evangelicals to Bush. There was a lot of effort to kind of recruit Black pastors into the kind of anti-gay cause. A lot of the times, anti-gay marriage rallies would double as what they call racial reconciliation rallies, so that people can kind of, you know, join hands brought together by the unifying force of homophobia. And as a result, Bush's share of the Black vote in Ohio doubled in 2004. I think that there's a pretty good argument to be made that Bush would not have won Ohio if it weren't for Issue One.
The way you describe it, it's almost like a conscious campaign with organizers of the religious, of the Christian right, saying, well, now that we really want to be inclusive of African Americans, we certainly don't want to, you know, demonize Jews. Let's demonize homosexuals because we need an enemy. Do you have any evidence that it was as kind of a conscious decision as that?
Oh, I actually don't know if it's conscious. I mean, I certainly believe that their antipathy towards gay people is real. I do think that it's been, you've seen it kind of mushroom as other enemies have become, you know, as it has become politically more difficult to attack other enemies. It's absolute. I think that there's no doubt that it's been consciously manipulated to bring African Americans into the Christian right and into the Republican Party. There's a really fascinating video called Gay Rights, Special Rights, which is about how homosexuals have usurped the apparently noble civil rights movement. And one of the talking heads on that is Trent Lott, who has never before been a great champion of Martin Luther King. You know, as everyone knows, he was forced to step down from his role as Senate Majority Leader after praising the Dixiecrat presidential campaign of Strom Thurmond. So when people like that start talking about how gay people pose a threat to the noble legacy of the civil rights movement, I think it's pretty clear that there's something cynical going on.
You've gone to a lot of conferences organized by leaders of the Christian right. One of them that you recently wrote about in Salon magazine online was the War on Christians. And this was a conference mm-hmm. that was held at the end of March. What was the premise of the conference?
One of the ideas that's really taken over the movement is that Christianity is under siege, that it's on, that thanks to the efforts of the homosexual lobby, it's on the verge of being outlawed, and that, you know, basically secularists are waging this war on Christianity in every aspect of the culture. And so Rick Scarborough, who put this conference together, someone who's very close to Tom DeLay, has been, you know, a kind of major mover behind this idea. Last year, he organized a conference where there was a lot of talk about, you know, the war on Christmas. So now the war on Christmas has become the war on Christians. And the examples of this, you know, ostensible war usually involve either attempts to maintain separation of church and state, you know, attempts to not have, you know, government-sponsored major scenes in City Hall, or attempts to create expanded tolerance for gay couples. They essentially say that since their reading of the Bible, you know, treats homosexuality as an abomination, to force them to tolerate gay unions, to force them to not discriminate against gay people is, you know, a kind of fundamental assault on their religion.
The organizer of the conference, Rick Scarborough, introduced Tom DeLay, who was one of the speakers at the conference. And in introducing him, Scarborough said, "I believe the most damaging thing Tom DeLay has done in his life is to take his faith seriously in the public office, which made him a target of all of those who despise the goals of Christ." Tell us about Rick Scarborough, who is the organizer of this conference, The War on Christians.
Well, Rick Scarborough used to be, or he was a pastor in Pearland, Texas. He's been very close to Tom DeLay. And he now runs a group called Vision America. The idea behind it is to organize what he calls, quote, patriot pastors for political action. And the kind of, you know, the thing that he uses to rile people up is this idea that Christianity is under siege. And he's been really skillful at interpreting Tom DeLay's legal troubles, among other things, as, you know, not evidence of the kind of bankruptcy of some of their leaders, but evidence of the war on Christians, so that anytime their leaders are defeated or unmasked or shown to be corrupt, it just kind of further strengthens their, you know, their belief in this idea that there's this kind of giant conspiracy working against them. And he, I think Jerry Falwell identified Scarborough as one of the kind of new leaders of the Christian right. He's part of a new generation of Christian right organizers who tend to work on the state level, organizing church by church, pastor by pastor, and trying to basically turn conservative evangelical pastors into political operatives.
How politically connected is Scarborough?
Well, he's obviously very close to Tom DeLay, as I said, and you've seen at his conferences, he had a conference last year and now this one, you see, you know, a lot of high-level Republicans coming and speaking, often with really quite, sharing stages with people who are really quite extreme. So you had at this conference, Senator John Cornyn, you know, gave a speech along with Tom DeLay and two other Republican congressmen as well. At one of his events last year, you had, you know, I think Tom Coburn's chief of staff. You had the guy who used to advise Bill Frist on judicial nominations, you know, along with other congressmen and Tom DeLay giving a video greeting from because he couldn't be there because of the Pope's funeral. And what's fascinating to me is that some of the other people who tend to appear at these conferences are people who are kind of unabashed theocrats, people who are Christian Reconstructionists who adhere to an ideology that proposes replacing civil law with biblical law, you know, that would execute people for, you know, vast numbers of moral crimes. That is very, it's openly theocratic. You know, people like Howard Phillips, Herb Titus, obscure figures, but figures that I think it used to be Republicans wouldn't want to be openly associated with. I mean, these people used to be considered beyond the pale. They are still considered beyond the pale, but I think it's very telling that Republicans feel less compunction about sharing a stage with them or sharing a banquet table with them.
With Tom DeLay on his way out, who are some of the leaders in Congress who are connected to the religious right?
Well, there's Hofstetter from Indiana, who was very influential in trying to make sure that the Air Force Academy didn't impose any anti-discrimination guidelines when they were accused of allowing proselytizing to cadets. There is Souder, who recently intervened to have abstinence proponents added to this CDC panel. In the Senate, there's Rick Santorum, who's probably going to lose in 2006. But you also have people like Tom Coburn, Sam Brownback, Jim DeMint. I think it's important to realize that this is a movement that has a lot of different centers of power. So the fall of Tom DeLay, while a blow to the movement, is definitely not going to decapitate it.
My guest is Michelle Goldberg. Her new book is called Kingdom Coming, The Rise of Christian Nationalism. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Michelle Goldberg. She's the author of the new book, Kingdom Coming, The Rise of Christian Nationalism. And she covers the Christian right and other subjects for the online magazine Salon. One of the architects of the Christian right, Pat Robertson, who founded the Christian Coalition, has become something of an embarrassment for people because, you know, he's called for the assassination of a head of state. He said that Sharon's stroke was punishment for his own policies. How are people in the Christian right now dealing with Pat Robertson now that Pat Robertson is largely regarded as a real loose cannon?
He is regarded as a loose cannon, and he is somebody who they try to marginalize, especially in public. At the same time, I think that the extent to which Pat Robertson has been kind of sidelined is a little bit overstated. I mean, people feel the need to denounce him. They feel the need to distance themselves from him. He's still a very important figure. Just a couple of months ago, there was a big conference at his university, Regent University, about Reagan's legacy and the future of conservatism. And you saw people like Marvin Olasky, the editor of World Magazine, which is a very influential evangelical magazine. Olasky is also a former Bush advisor. You know, he went to the conference. People like Bill Kristol from the Weekly Standard went to the conference. So although people kind of need to distance themselves from Robertson in public, he's certainly not somebody who's now completely out of the loop. And another thing I would point out is that his charity has received millions of dollars in government contracts, partly under Bush's faith-based initiative. It's called Operation Blessing. And he received something like $1.5 million under a contract to essentially distribute the money to other smaller religious groups to kind of teach them how to get government contracts and how to do social service work that the Bush administration is increasingly turning over to the religious right. And he's also received something like $14 million in powdered milk donations for his overseas operations. So although this is somebody who's something of an embarrassment, he's definitely still a player.
What's your approach to covering the religious right?
Usually I just show up. I'm, you know, kind of somewhat non-obtrusive person. I kind of blend in a little bit. So, you know, I go to church, I go to these conferences, and I talk to the people around me. You know, I'll approach the leaders and interview them. And when people, I don't quite go undercover. I mean, I might blend in a little bit, but I don't lie about what I'm there, about why I'm there. If people ask me, I'll tell them I'm a reporter. I'm working on a book about the culture wars. You know, if people press me further, I usually tell them where I'm coming from. And so, you know, part of the time I just kind of blend in and hear what people are saying. And then part of the time I try to engage people in conversation. I find that most people, myself included, want to say what they really think. It's really hard to keep your real opinions to yourself. So even if people feel like my agenda might be suspicious, you know, most people want to talk about their beliefs.
You've described, you know, the Christian right as an almost parallel world with, in many cases, with its own schools and its own music and its own sense of American history. Mm-hmm. Do you think, if you see the Christian right as a parallel world, you see it as a parallel world that a lot of people aren't aware exists?
Well, I think people on the coasts aren't aware that it exists. You know, I often feel like people in New York, where I live, or San Francisco, or any of the big cities, feel like it's just this tiny fringe subculture, when in many cases, it's more mainstream than we are. You know, the Left Behind books are the best-selling books of fiction in America, and yet secular people on the coast, unless they're kind of connected to the publishing industry, have usually not heard of them and have almost certainly never read them. I don't know anyone, except for people who grew up in that subculture and then left, who's ever been inside of a megachurch. You know, and yet these are an increasingly important part of the American landscape. I mean, part of it is because the cultural division in this country has become so profound, and because there is such a separation in terms of the media that we consume, that we can be kind of completely oblivious to what is the reality for so many other Americans.
The Christian right was very helpful to the Bush-Cheney ticket in getting them elected and reelected. And I'm wondering, now that the president's popularity has decreased in the polls, has that affected the relationship between the president and the Christian right?
I think there's no doubt that there's disillusionment and dejection at the conference, the War on Christians conference in March. I mean, the kind of lack of energy was, you know, really noticeable, especially compared to the conference last year. At the same time, I think that Bush's decreasing approval ratings is going to make him more dependent than ever on getting out his base. And so there's going to be, I believe, increasing kind of sops and increasing attempts to get people riled up in time for November. You know, one of the most important things they're doing is reintroducing an attempt to pass a federal constitutional amendment banning gay marriage in June. And so there's going to be efforts like that to get people excited and to get people to turn out, because I think they realize that's the only way they're going to hang on to either House in 2006.
Well, Michelle Goldberg, thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Michelle Goldberg is the author of the new book, Kingdom Coming, The Rise of Christian Nationalism. Coming up, an influential rapper and producer have teamed up to create a new combined fictional persona, and Milo Miles has a review of their new CD. This is Fresh Air. When it was released in the United Kingdom this spring, the single Crazy by Gnarls Barkley became the first single to top the pop charts in Britain based on download sales alone. Crazy is from the album St. Elsewhere. The album was released May 1st in the UK and on Tuesday in the US. Gnarls Barkley is not a person, but the fictional combined persona of two Americans, producer and DJ Danger Mouse and rapper and songwriter CeeLo. A decade ago, as the key rapper with Atlanta's Goody Mob, CeeLo helped develop the down-to-earth style known as Dirty South. Danger Mouse became notorious for the Grey album, a mashup which combined the music of the Beatles' White album with raps from Jay-Z's The Black album. Critic Milo Miles has a review of their Gnarls Barkley collaboration.
Gnarls Barkley's St. Elsewhere album begins and ends with the sound of film running through a projector. So it's meant to be a movie for the years. And if so, it's an old-fashioned higgledy-piggledy Saturday matinee, with some cheapo horror and sci-fi mixed with outrageous slapstick and cartoons, and a load of sly fun. 3 years ago, CeeLo and Danger Mouse began to informally exchange tapes and build songs in an attempt to surprise and outdo each other. The result has now come out as Gnarls Barkley's St. Elsewhere. CeeLo and Danger Mouse have put out website stories trying to make Gnarls Barkley into some sort of crazy recluse. Don't even think of the NBA. But this is a case of artistic collaboration, intended to break molds and defeat expectations. It works because this is an inspired meeting of a mouth and a mind. CeeLo and Danger Mouse are a pair who have always been captivated by rock guitar, blues licks, and the anything-goes funk soul cavalcades associated with Prince, and before that, Parliament Funkadelic, and before that, Sly Stone. CeeLo also reminds me of another R&B eccentric called Swamp Dog, who made looking into his own head as lively and thrilling as prowling the streets. Typical is the breakout single, Crazy. Elsewhere, CeeLo touches on suicidal depression in Just a Thought, and fragmentary personality in Transformer and Who Cares. He also gets into, well, sex after death in Necromancer, but that's a pretty ridiculous track. It's also one of the few where he almost raps. Chance the lyrics is more like it. Mostly he delivers regular vocals. CeeLo has described himself not as a singer, but a sanger with an A, which means he makes up for his lack of range with personality and good humor. It's good that CeeLo takes pride in his common touch. Not so good that all his albums have duff moments, like here the undanceable dance anthem, The Last Time. Much smarter is his cover of the Violent Femmes' Gone Daddy Gone, where he can make his chance hit home and quote Muddy Waters in the same song.
And I can tell by the way that you switch and walk, and I can see by the way that you baby talk, and I can know by the way that you treat your man. I can love you, baby.
Gone Daddy Gone was Danger Mouse's idea, since he came up with all the music. He said he was trying to create a partly sampled and partly live modern psychedelic melange. Whatever he calls the music on St. Elsewhere, it's inventive, restless, headlong, expressive, and often droll. On the throwaway tracks of CeeLo's solo albums, the music marked time until he returned to something more substantial. On St. Elsewhere, the Danger Mouse background can carry the scene while CeeLo goofs around, as on Feng Shui.
In this house, the decor is the obvious obscure. It's clearly the theory of less is more. A plant of pet books on a shelf and a frame on the wall where you can picture yourself. And you're welcome to stay, but even your company must complement the feng shui. Even down to what I have on, made you wonder to what extent I have gone. Tailored the tape and contours of the curve, demanded the attention that it does deserve. Fabrics for the forecast of the day, I admit it, everything is fitted to fall in feng shui. More importantly, the way that I...
Does Gnarls Barkley have a second act? CeeLo and Danger Mouse are playing live dates this summer. But exactly how well they come across on stage doesn't matter as much in this age of phantom superstars. And Danger Mouse is an expert with unreality. Last year he helped tweak the return of Gorillaz, a band who only exist as cartoons, and they've been on the Billboard charts for nearly a year and sold 2 million copies. So Gnarls Barkley may yet end up in the virtual Hall of Fame.
Milo Miles lives in Cambridge. He reviewed St. Elsewhere by Gnarls Barkley. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Ferriby is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sherrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Nathaniel Hawthorne's The Scarlet Letter, available in stores and online at bn.com. From the Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities, on the web at wallacefoundation.org. And from the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
This Sunday, NBC's The West Wing presents its final episode after 7 seasons on the air. On the next Fresh Air, TV critic David Bianculli looks back on the series, and we feature interviews with 3 of its stars, Brad Whitford, Alan Alda, and the late John Spencer. Join us for the next Fresh Air.